The following is a 1500 ESPN Twin Cities production.
This is our legal expert, Jeff O'Brien. He's a well-recognized attorney from Lohmann Abdo in such areas as business law, commercial contract disputes, intellectual property, and more. He also knows his sports and can lend his expertise when there are legal issues at play. This is Dave Harrigan, a well-recognized producer and update host from the Mackey and Judd Show. He's not really an expert in anything, but here he is to introduce the topics to Jeff and then nod in agreement every time Mr. O'Brien makes a great point. Welcome to Case in Point with Jeff O'Brien. Here's Dave Harrigan.
Well, Jeff, we're back. It's episode 14, and I think I can venture to say this is going to be interesting. This is going to be a little fun.
It will be.
We're talking about some of the sweetheart deals in sports because, after all, we love watching it. But at the end of the day, we all know sports is a business. It is a very big business, and it has been a very profitable business for the select few people we are going to talk about. Let's dive right in. Let's talk about one of the best, one of the biggest sweetheart deals in sports, given to someone right in our very own backyard here. I think we've probably all heard of the Mike Lynn deal with the Vikings and the Metrodome. Dive through some of the particulars. What was it all about? Because it still shocks me to look at some of the numbers you have here. It's unbelievable.
I know. And this literally was a sweet deal.
Because
it dealt with Mike Lynn managing to negotiate for himself. This is, goes back to the construction of the Metrodome. So we're talking back to the Jimmy Carter presidency.
We're back in Met Stadium here.
As to when this deal was negotiated. And I think, I know there was some studies done as to whether or not it was feasible to renovate and modernize the Metrodome at the time when the stadium discussions were going on. And aside, I think that there was some discussion about that wasn't feasible. But aside from that, I honestly believe they actually had to knock the structure down to get out of this deal.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be one of my questions. The deal is now off the books.
The deal
right?
is now off the books. As soon as when the last event was held at the Metrodome and that sucker came down, Mike Lynn's estate no longer reaps any revenues from this deal. So what we're talking about is Mike Lynn, became the Vikings general manager in, I believe, 1974. Jim Finks sought ownership in the team. Max Winter said, no way. Jim Finks says, I'm out of here, heads to Chicago to be the general manager.
Okay.
And in walks, as my good friend and client Tommy Kramer calls him, former grocery store manager Mike Lynn. And what Mike Lynn did is, in the course of negotiating the deal for the Metrodome, which, of course, the Vikings were the driving force. There were threats that they were going to move to Arizona and all these places. And so they're going to build an indoor stadium for the Vikings. And he negotiated a provision with the team that gave him 10% of luxury suite revenue for every event at the Metrodome starting when the building opened in 1982.
Every event, not just Vikings games?
We'll get to that. But yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, jumping ahead. My apologies. Yeah,
but you're right. Not just any event. I mean, this was not just Vikings games. This was Twins games, Gopher football, tractor pulls,
Monster truck rallies, everything.
The Prep Bowl, if the suites were being used, concerts, everything. Anytime those suites were used at the Dome, Mike Lynn got 10% of the luxury suite revenue, which I kind of laugh because you may have been in those suites. I was in those suites. Calling those luxury suites at any time during the life of the Metrodome was a stretch.
Bit of a stretch. I was in one once, and let's just say I didn't have to pay for it, so I didn't line Mike Lynn's pocket. You're welcome.
So this deal starts in 1982, and it literally ran until 2014 2013, the last time there was ever a game at the Dome.
Wow.
The deal ended.
So that final game, that final Vikings game at the Dome before they started tearing it down pretty much as people were walking out of the building, he was the one shedding a tear.
Exactly. Because over the course of the 30 years of the deal, the estimates are he made $14 to $20 million. He apparently rejected at least one buyout offer from later Vikings ownership groups And he continued to earn $700,000, $1 million every year until the Vikings left the Metrodome.
Wow.
Now, how it came about was Max Winter, who was then the Vikings owner, wanted Mike Lynn to help get the Metrodome deal done, the publicly funded Metrodome, and protect his flank from what who he saw viewed as a possibly a ruthless subordinate. Because Mike Lynn, for the better part of, I think, the 80s and through the end of his tenure at the Vikings, worked on trying to buy the Vikings. And to the point of, you look at the Herschel Walker trade, part of that, the sinister motive behind that was he didn't want to have to pay all those draft choices, so why not just get rid of them? Because he wanted to get the team's value down low enough so he could buy them.
Wow.
He was a shark, and Max Winter recognized it and threw this as his bone to keep his loyalty. Max Winter had his lawyer, who was Sam Kaplan, who later went on to be, we know him from political circles, as later became the ambassador to Morocco.
Okay.
And he drew up this box suite agreement. The part of it also was Mike Lynn wanted to keep the Vikings outdoors in the suburbs. Max Winter wanted to come downtown to Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And so this was his motivation to Remarkable Mike to go with what Max wanted and not undercut him and go put together a deal out in the suburbs.
Wow.
So what happens, the Vikings, the Metrodome had a budget of $55 million. The Vikings, to keep it from going over, the Vikings paid for the construction of the luxury suites. That's how the Vikings had the right to make this deal.
Okay, that's where I was going to ask, how they can negotiate on the behalf of the Twins.
So they had this company, Vikings Development, that managed the private suites.
So with even a Twins game, did the Twins not get a dime of that revenue?
I believe they may have got some.
Okay.
I'm not clear on that.
But a good portion went to the Vikings.
Yeah, a good portion to the Vikings because they paid for the suites. And then, of course, Mike Lynn negotiates this side deal.
Wow.
In it. So, so that was that. It's probably one of the more legendary business deals in sports on the Minnesota scene. So, yes, it definitely was a sweet deal. But it was not as sweet, Dave, as what Ozzie and Daniel Silna did down in St. Louis
and
with
NBA. I'm interested in this. You mentioned they were the spirits of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
The ABA team almost was an NBA team. This is one I've heard about, but I don't know any of the details. So.
Well, and there's a great, if anybody that's out there that has Netflix, there is a ESPN 30 for 30 documentary on the spirits of St. Louis. They touch at the end about this deal, but mainly it's about the team. But if anybody wants to know about the spirits of St. Louis, go to Netflix and look up that 30 for 30.
Awesome.
So Ozzie and Daniel Silna, they made their money in making polyester.
And we're talking years ago. Obviously.
Yes, we are. And in 1974, they desperately wanted to own an NBA team. And they tried to buy the Detroit Pistons. That didn't happen. So they bought an ABA franchise. If you remember, the American Basketball Association was out there at that time and going to the cities where the NBA wasn't.
Mm-hmm. And still a bit of a rival league at this point, right?
Yes, very much was a rival league. This is, of course, in the 70s we had a competing league we had the World Football League that sputtered out. And we had, in hockey, we had the American Hockey, Hockey League. So you had these competing leagues that tried to spend a lot of money to compete with the biggies and flamed out quickly.
Sure.
And, of course, that ends up being the fate of the ABA, but not before they made some headlines competing with the established NBA. So the Silnas buy the ABA franchise Carolina Cougars, and their whole reason for doing it is they expect that there was going to be a merger of the two leagues. They were going to buy this franchise, and it was going to merge into the NBA, and they were going to own an NBA franchise. This is how they were going to get into the league. Since they couldn't buy the Pistons, they couldn't buy an existing NBA franchise, they were going to go to the ABA and buy a team that was going to merge into the league.
Okay.
So they end up moving the Cougars to St. Louis, Missouri. It was because at the time it was the largest city in the U.S. without a professional basketball team, and they thought, this is all strategy-wise here, mm-hmm. they thought that would make their team more likely to be invited to join the NBA.
Makes sense.
So in 1974, the Cougars, or the roster and the overhaul, became the Spirits of St. Louis, and they played there from 74 until 1976. But problem was, in 75, the 75-76 season, the team's performance starts to go down and attendance starts to wane.
Uh-oh.
And they were not included in the ABA-NBA merger. and the players for St. Louis and the Kentucky Colonels, they were going to be put into a dispersal draft. So now while the Sooners were left out of the NBA, I think they ended up with the last laugh. They ended up getting the best deal.
Well, from the numbers I'm seeing, yeah, I think I'd have to agree here. This is unbelievable what you're about to get into.
Yep. So the Spirits, you know, what happened is certain ABA teams were paid to fold. The Virginia Squires, the Kentucky Colonels. And they were paid $3.3 million from the remaining ABA teams, the ones that are going to merge into the NBA.
Now, why do you have to pay them to fold? I mean, if the NBA wants these four teams, can't they just say, sorry, good luck to you?
Nothing said. You know, I think that I don't know what the league's bylaws were or anything in terms of approving the merger or how it was determined. But for whatever reason, the teams that were going to merge had to somehow deal with the teams that were going to be left behind.
It may have just been an ABA provision.
Exactly.
Perhaps?
Okay. Exactly. So the Spirits, though, held out for more money. And so what happens is that the owners of the four teams that are going to merge from the ABA to the NBA, which is the Nuggets, the Pacers, the Nets, and the Spurs, agree to pay the Sooners $2.2 million up front. And here's where it gets fun. An additional 1/7 share of the four remaining teams' television broadcast revenues for as long as the NBA or its successors continues in existence. So the idea was that they're going to get a percentage of the merged teams' TV revenue in perpetuity.
So 1/7 of the revenue from each team.
Yep. And then the Sooners put a clause in there saying that the share couldn't drop below the amount generated from a 28-team league. NBA, of course, has expanded now. And so the Sooners are ending up making the first year. So 1980-81 was the first year that the deal yielded revenue for the Sooners. And they received just a modest amount, $521,749.
Oh, yeah, modest.
Then we get into the 80s and 90s when, you know, Michael Jordan comes in.
Yeah, and NBA blew up at
exactly.
that point, yeah.
And when the television rights were sold to CBS and to NBC and then TNT and TBS later. So because of this deal, through the 80s, the Sooners made at least $4.4 million from the 80s through the 80s into the 90s. From 1999 through 2002, the deal reportedly netted them at least $12.53 million per year.
So it was 4.4 per year.
Yep.
Now we're up to 12.
Now we get from 2003 to 2006, $15.6 million a year. 2010 to 11, they're receiving $17.45 million annually. The NBA and the teams that are involved say, we got to do something about this. This is not what was intended.
No kidding. Because so, as you said, it was going on in
It was
perpetuity.
Costing each of these teams $5 million a year.
And the deal would never end.
Yep. As of 2014, they had received roughly $300 million in revenue from this deal that they had negotiated.
Wow.
Even though their team never played an NBA game.
And they rejected the $3.3 million offer. That looks like a good deal to me.
Yep. Interesting thing is, of the revenues they received, their attorney got 10% too. So, you know, kudos to the attorney who negotiated the deal to get himself into the deal too.
Do you have any deals coming? Up?
I wish. Hats off there. So in January 2014, the NBA, the former ABA clubs and the Sooners did negotiate a settlement. They received a $500 million upfront payment from the former ABA teams. And the way they did it, Dave, is those teams end up getting the majority stake in the Spirits of St. Louis Basketball Club, LP, which retains control of the portion of the TV revenue streams of those teams, with the option to purchase the remaining stake held by the Sooners in the future. So they still get some amount of revenue from the NBA. They just don't get this ungodly number like they used to. So they cut. They basically stop the bleed. They turn the faucet off to where it's a slow trickle rather than pouring out.
So those four teams you said what the Spurs, the Nets,
Nuggets,
the Nuggets, yep. Pacers.
Yep.
They split the $500 million between the four teams.
Yes. Oh, and the NBA was part of that too. The league did get it. I don't know how it was allocated. The league shared in that payment to the Sooners.
Okay, but yet, so here's the deal: we'll cut off the faucet. We'll give you $500 million, but we'll still have a slow trickle.
Yeah. So I haven't seen any numbers as to what's left over, how it gets it. But this, they certainly took care of the the most significant amount of revenue that was going out the door to these guys.
Wow, that puts Mike Lynn to shame.
I know. He probably looked back at this deal and said, I should have been in basketball. I should have got left for grocery stores for basketball instead of football.
Jump into this quickly. The Greg Norman deal. There's another one. I've never heard about.
I didn't until I was doing some research for this episode. So Greg Norman, the Great White Shark, signed on as the spokesman for Cobra Golf in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Cobra was just an independent golf manufacturer at that time, and so it wouldn't be uncommon when you have a deal like that to do what they did. And Cobra gave him partial ownership in the company and the opportunity to own Cobra's distribution network in Australia, his home country.
And I suppose as a small outfit, they needed to make a big splash to get a guy like Greg Norman, who was king of the golf world.
Exactly.
At that point,
and of course, you think about 1991, you know, Norman was kind of top of the golf world.
Absolutely.
And he also helped design the company's first forged iron. So Greg Norman was an integral player in Cobra Golf during the time that he was involved with them. In 1996, Cobra then sells off the company to Fortune Brands, which is the owner of Titleist. He received, and Greg Norman received $44 million for his ownership stake in Cobra.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Here's an interesting side note on that one. The $44 million that he reaped from the sale was in part responsible for his rift with his representation, IMG. They wanted a cut of his profits, but he insisted that he had negotiated the deal himself. Again, not. I haven't had it happen, but it wouldn't be surprised. You know, you get someone you negotiate a good deal for somebody, and at the end of the deal, say, "Well, I really did it myself, mm-hmm. and I don't want to pay you." So, you know, it's always for the attorneys, for the agent. It's always that, you know, make sure they get. It's always difficult sometimes to get paid at the end.
Sure. Would that argument have been decided in court then?
Didn't see anything more about what happened. I guess they did part ways though over that.
Wow.
But anyway, so there's an example of, you know, he signed on to be the face of a small company, and it ended up being lucrative for that company, which ended up being lucrative for him, and he, you know, went on. Now I think since that time, you know, Cobra is still around. It's just a subsidiary of Fortune Brands.
Yeah.
And I believe that at some point later on, a couple of years ago, I think Greg Norman did come back and actually become a spokesman for Cobra Golf again. So
okay.
I don't know if he still is now, but he did at least a second stint with them later on following this sale. Nothing with this kind of ownership provision. It was just a straight up endorsement deal. But you can see why a small company with a get like that would do something like this.
Yeah, and if you can sell off to the company that owns Titleist, I suppose everybody's happy in the end, regardless
right.
of how much is paid out.
Right. Now, in terms of kind of the legal underpinnings of any of these deals, all this comes down to, Dave, is just contract law and contract negotiations.
Which is way over my head.
Well,
so you're on your own.
And so with contract law, and there's not a whole lot to contract law in terms of what elements you have for a valid contract. So the legal standard, the requisite elements that have to be established to demonstrate the formation of a legally binding contract are six of them: an offer, an acceptance, consideration, which is usually, you know, the law doesn't look at the adequacy of the consideration. They just have to reference, you know, you always see, if you've seen a contract says for $1 and other good and valuable consideration, that's what they're referencing. Get this into the box of consideration.
Sure. Okay.
The mutuality of obligation. Both parties are obligated to do something under the contract. Competency and capacity. Obviously, you have to be competent and have the mental and legal capacity to sign mm-hmm. a document. And in some cases, which we call the statute of fraud, you have to have a written instrument. The law provides for certain types of contracts that have to be in writing to be enforceable.
Okay.
So as long as these requirements are met, then it's up to the parties and their team and to negotiate the terms of the deal. And the law doesn't protect somebody from making a bad deal.
Makes sense, yeah.
And these deals weren't necessarily bad. You look back at what the circumstances that went about going, you know, like you look at the Mike Lynn deal. Obviously, Max Winter had a desire to have Mike do something for him mm-hmm. on these stadium negotiations. So he offered him this carrot of the percentage of the suite revenue that the Vikings were going to take in to get him to do that. So
yeah.
Max Winter got his outdoor publicly funded stadium in downtown Minneapolis, and Mike Lynn got his multi-millions from the sweet deal. And, so it worked out for both of them.
And Winter wasn't exactly owning the Vikings for all those years. The team played in the Dome anyway.
Exactly. So. Exactly. The Silnas. So the NBA want, you know, the ABA teams that were going to go to the NBA wanted to go into the NBA. They had to do something with the Silnas. They gave them something. I think this one is probably one of a little bit unforeseen circumstances because the NBA in the 70s was not what it is now.
You'd have to think they wish they would have sweetened the deal with, you know, a little more upfront money versus the deal they did get.
So that's why you end up with the buyout later, because they're trying to cut off stem the tide of this deal that produced an unforeseen result. And then finally with Cobra, they had a big get. They had a superstar of golf that was going to be their spokesman. Yeah, why not give him ownership? And especially if he's going to be active involved in the company and helping him design product, all the better.
Okay.
So these aren't necessarily a bad deal. It just ended up, you know, one party did really well, you know, in these deals. But we see this a lot of times in business law, various ways that we end up with these kind of possibly sweetheart deals. So I do a lot of private stock offerings for some small companies. And very often to get investors into a startup business, you might offer them something called a preferred return. Mm-hmm. They may get a guaranteed percent return on their money every year. Okay. Well, one of the things we do when we analyze deals like that and figure out, you know, how the founders are going to make money is sometimes you have to say that lasts for, say, 5 years or 7 years and have some way that provision sunsets. Otherwise, you might be paying your, you know, folks that might come in, granted they're coming in at a time when you need the money, but they may end up making a very lucrative return going forward if you don't address a sunset provision on a distribution like that. When you're dealing with in the context of a sale of a business, sometimes there may be, you know, the parties may not be able to necessarily agree on a final number for the sale in terms of a lump sum. So there may be what we call an earnout. There may be, you know, you may have someone stay involved with the company and part of their compensation or part of their sale price might be based on future performance of the company after the sale. So there might be a percentage of gross sales or net sales or things like that. So you have an earnout situation. Same kind of thing. You're talking about a percentage, right? You got that variable in there of what could happen. And then finally, licensing and royalty payments. You know, a lot of times someone might invent a great product, but they just don't have the financial capacity to
get
take
to
that
market.
Product.
Yeah.
Exactly. Take it to market.
So when you go on Shark Tank, right?
Get
some Cuban money behind
or,
you.
Or, you know, in this area, in this community, a lot of folks might come up with some kind of a medical device type product or medical healthcare invention. And the hope is that they can at least get it to the point to get a prototype, maybe get FDA approval and get the interest of a Medtronic or a St. Jude or somebody that would be interested in purchasing it and making it. And then, of course, under that deal, you'd get some sort of a royalty payment for a period of time. So there's a lot of places in business where you get these types of percentage deals or kind of these speculative deals that, you know, if the chips fall a certain way, they could end up being very lucrative for the party, for one or both of more of the parties that enter into them.
Sure.
And, you know, the one more here in terms of these kind of example of one of these kind of sweetheart deals from the business world, the non-sports world, is the story of how Toyota built their distribution in the U.S. There was a gentleman by the name of Jim Moran. He had a company called Moran Automotive. Mm-hmm. He was a Chevy dealer in Chicago in the 1950s. And we go back to the 1960s, late 60s, Toyota was trying to get dealers in the U.S. to sell their cars. And the founder of Toyota was actually traveling around the U.S. trying to sell the idea of a small economical car to dealers, and he got zero interest. I mean, at that point, you're talking about the 60s. This is before the emission standards and everything else. Nobody wanted small cars. Everybody
driving
wanted
boats around,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So Mr. Moran said he would build the dealerships, but he had to be made the distributor of Toyota in the U.S. Now, Toyota countered and said, no, but we'll give you the southeastern United States.
Okay.
So October 26, 1968, Jim Moran enters into a deal with Toyota to distribute Toyota vehicles from the port in Jacksonville, Florida, to the states of Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and North and South Carolina. So he gets a territory of the distribution network. And he founded his company called Southeast Toyota Distributors that same year, in 1968. And in 2006, so 1 year before his death, this company had sold over 400,000 vehicles, 20% of all the new Toyotas sold in the United States. So we're talking about a very good deal.
That's a windfall.
Yes. Now, Mr. Moran later had some legal problems with the IRS and other folks. Interesting, the Silnas lost a little bit of their money in the Bernie Madoff debacle, a Ponzi scheme from a few years ago. So they don't always keep the money. I think Mike Lynn might have been buried with his.
Yeah, well, there's that. I think I'd still rather be the Silnas. I wouldn't mind.
Yeah, the if I had to pick one of these, I would go with the Silnas. That's a nice deal.
Yeah, that's okay. Wow, that's...
So the kind of the takeaways here, Dave, are, you know, when you do not... I always say when it comes to dealing with legal issues, particularly contract negotiations, DIY usually equals SOL.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, so if you're out there, if you're doing some sort of a business transaction, whether it be an individual or for an inventor or for your company, if you're raising money, if you're doing a deal with another company or somebody else, contact an attorney. You need to have help in all these deals we talk about. There was representation there, you know, in being involved with these deals. So the big thing is, if you know, make sure all these deals are product of negotiation, and it always helps to have a professional on your side handling these negotiations.
Yeah, I imagine so.
So it means, so it's interesting kind of case studies. You know, when we talk about sports as a business, we always think of the player contracts, the collective bargaining, the stadium deals, endorsements, not thinking that, yes, it is a business. There are everyday, ordinary business transactions that happen in the sports world all the time. These are three examples of some that were individuals did very well as part of the deals. But it is, sports is a business.
And for the practicality for you, Jeff, as a lawyer, make sure for your next business deal you don't get the Greg Norman treatment. You have to actually get that piece of it. Don't let your clients just
say attorneys listening that are going to be involved with these deals, make sure you have your retainer agreement clearly specified what percentage you get, have it signed by the client, and have it in your folder, possibly in a vault, if need be, to make sure that you get your share if one of these deals comes to pass.
All of us are very worried about the attorneys.
We should always be worried about how the attorneys get paid.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you. This was fascinating. Case in point, make sure you check us out. First of all, the Facebook page, Case in Point on Facebook. You can find us there. Mm-hmm. Podcast one, 1500ESPN.com. iTunes, give us that iTunes ranking if you could. Jeff O'Brien, Loman Abdo, thanks again, and we'll do this again soon.
Thank you, Dave.